Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order March 18th, 2024, 2 minutes after 9 a.m. With me today is Chairman Olson, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel, and myself, Stedman. Chairing, we'll have Senator Wilson joining us later, and Senator Hoffman is excused, but he might even arrive before this meeting's over. We're not sure. This morning, we're going to have another update on the state's fiscal position, dealing with the current release of the new spring forecast. So there's a little additional revenue, but there's also additional expenditures through amendments that were put on the table last week by the administration. And then we have quite a litany of things that aren't in the budget, some big ticket items, and then a couple of areas that the committee may want to have a comment or two on through this presentation this morning, dealing with forest fire dollar amounts and or cushion, or what we call headroom, how much we should have leave on the table for supplemental budget adjustments next winter, and then any effect on our savings position in the CBR. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and call Mr. Alexi Painter to the table, please. He is the director of the Nonpartisan Legislative Finance Office. And if he could walk us through his presentation, and we'll do the standard one slide at a time discussion until we're done. Mr. Painter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. So the first slide here is a new fiscal summary of the governor's amended budget, including the amendments released last week and the spring revenue forecast. So the spring revenue forecast, as you heard, increased FY24 revenue expectations by about $58 million and FY25 revenue by about $140 million versus the fall revenue forecast. In addition, the governor has an amendment to the budget that would increase last year's FY24 aided dividend by $6.9 million. That shows up as UGF revenue is included in that first line on revenue, but that is a budget amendment, so it's a revenue increase, but not through the revenue forecast. So combined with the $54 million of new revenue and then that amount, it's about $61 million of new revenue in FY24. That new revenue in FY24, I'll wait till the next slide to talk about more about FY24 at various prices. But with that additional revenue, that doesn't really increase the bottom line that's spendable in FY24 because of the provision that's often called the waterfall, where it's two buckets. But it would be if revenue exceeds the spring 2023 revenue forecast, the additional amount up to a total of $636 million would be split 50-50 between an energy relief payment in FY20 that would go out in FY25 and the Constitutional Budget Reserve. So we've increased our estimate for that bucket to $143.3 million for each. It was $110.6 based on the fall forecast. I would note that aided dividend amendment creates UGF revenue that would then just go into the energy relief and CBR transfers while the governor uses the funds directly to as an appropriation. The UGF revenue still just goes into those two buckets, so it doesn't decrease the deficit by spending that revenue in the budget. The governor's supplementals now total $175.8 million here on the bottom. That's a decrease from $183 million prior to the amendments. The decrease in fire suppression by $19 million resulted in offsetting some other supplementals that the governor put forward. So after supplementals, there is $116.5 million left in FY24 that's either spendable or would lapse to the CBR at the end of the year if it's unspent. In FY25, the governor's amendments increased the budget a little bit, but the revenue more than offset it. So the governor's budget now shows a post-transfer deficit of about $867 million, down from about $1 billion in the fall forecast. So slight upward adjustment there from what we saw before. Next slide shows a visual representation of FY24. I know this has been kind of confusing, so I'm going to try to walk through FY24 a little more. So last year, we built the budget based on the spring forecast that had, after the governor's vetoes, a $292.3 million surplus. Then any additional revenue went into those two buckets. So this blue bar on the bottom is revenue that would go to fill the existing FY24 budget. The dark blue on the top is the governor's new supplementals, the $175.8 million. So below about $75 a barrel, the budget has an unfilled deficit. So that's $75 for the entire year. It would take prices being, you know, $40, $50 or so the rest of the year to hit that low. The break-even point earlier in the session, I think we had said like $71 million or so. That's gone up because of those supplementals. Below that, we'd have an unfilled deficit, need a CPR draw. But again, that'd be very unlikely given where prices have been so far and that we're, you know, nearly three quarters of the way through the fiscal year at this point. The yellow bar here is that surplus that's available for supplementals or lapse after the governor's supplementals. So that's the $116.5 million. And then additional revenue beyond that gets split between, in orange, that energy relief payment, and green, the CBR. And then the budget last year appropriated any additional surplus beyond that to the CBR. So as you see prices rise, if prices rise, that would, result in an additional CBR draw. Again, given that we're nearly three quarters of the way through the year with prices so far, we'd expect the revenue will fall somewhere between the $78 to $90 range unless things really change drastically. And so we're likely in a situation where we have that $116.5 million to spend beyond the governor's supplementals. And then the additional amount will just be a question of how much goes into energy relief versus the CBR. Based on the spring forecast, we would estimate that transfer to the energy relief would be about a $220 additional payment on top of the dividend this fall. So as the chairman said, there's still some outstanding items. There's a vote later today on Senate Bill 241, the fiscal notes for, sorry, I said 241, that's the amount of fiscal notes. Senate Bill 140, fiscal notes are 241. I wrote that wrong on the slide, related to the two numbers. The cost of the bill is $241 million, the bill number is 140. So that bill, the veto override will be later today. We'll see where we are. I would note that that bill, there's several components to the cost increase of it. There's a BSA change. There's a change to the multiplier for correspondence students. There's a pupil transportation increase. All of those items could be converted to one-time budget items. The correspondence increase would be a bit of a challenge to write the language, but I think it's doable. Those things could be built into the budget without the bill. The other item, there's about $40 million for broadband. It would be difficult to... We're facing a federal deadline for applications. At this point, if the veto stands, it's unlikely that those applications could get in time to make that spending go out. So if the bill ends up, you know, the veto gets sustained, then we would expect that $40 million probably would not be needed this year or be able to be spent because even changing that statute now would likely be too late for that federal application. So that's kind of the material stakes of the veto override, I suppose, because beyond that, we could, in the budget, put most of those items in.
Senator Bishop.
Lexi, good morning. Is it March 27th or 28th the deadline for the bag increase, or status quo stays the same if we don't get it funded?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I don't remember the exact date, but it's coming up very soon, so we'd have to get that bill in very quickly if this does happen. I know it's this month, but I'm not confident on the date.
Any other questions on this slide?
So continuing on, there's other legislation that we should probably factor in. There's senior benefits legislation passed by this body with a $23.5 million UJF fiscal note to continue that bill or continue that program. I'll mention a few others, other bills that have passed one body in a subsequent slide. In the Alaska Marine Highway, there's a shortfall of up to $38 million in calendar year 25. That would assume that we have the same size grant from the federal government as calendar year 24 and a full seven ship schedule. If we ran a smaller, a lighter schedule or receive a larger grant, which we are eligible for, but the federal government has discretion about how to award it, that $38 million could shrink or disappear. Last year, we dealt with that uncertainty by adding backstop language of $10 million. Well, we added $20 million, got vetoed down to $10 million. So if we added that, that could potentially count towards the budget, but only would be triggered if needed because of the size of the federal amount. There's also ongoing employee bargaining negotiations. There's actually four unions. I think last time I said three, but that only counts the ones negotiated by Department of Administration. So there's three that are non-university unions. There's the Alaska Correctional Officers Association, the Alaska Public Employees Association Supervisory Unit, and the Labor Trades and Crafts are all negotiating currently. I believe this committee will get an update on those on Friday. And then there's a new University of Alaska Graduate Student Employees Union that is also negotiating to create their first contract. All of these are not yet factored into the budget yet, so it's unclear exactly what the cost will be for that, but I would expect that it'll be in the millions of dollars at least. In addition, there's a statutory tie between the supervisor union and exempt salaries. There's a bill in Ledge Council to clarify that language, or submitted by Ledge Council to clarify that language. But we could expect that there's a possibility, at least, that any increase given to the supervisor unit would then go to exempt employees as well, which would increase the cost we're looking at. So right now, those are just unknowns. The statutory deadline for contractual negotiations to be submitted by the legislature was actually last Friday, day 60, but we rarely get them by that date. We often get them later, all the way until, I believe the chairman a couple of years ago offered an amendment on the Senate floor to add a late arriving amendment or contract. So they cannot come quite late at times.
Okay. Slide.
Slide five. So getting to a balanced budget or where we might be at the end of the year. So the spring revenue forecast revenue is at the top, and then we have the governor's amended budget, operating budget plus transfers, his capital budget. Those combined leave a bit over $1.4 billion. So there's a few bills that have passed one or both bodies, SB 140 that I mentioned, passed both. Senior benefits passed the Senate. Then there's other bills that have passed one body or the other. Those UGF impacts total $11 million. So if you assume that all those bills or similar cost bills pass, we would have $1.16 billion to spend. So at various PFD levels with the 75-25 PFD, that would leave $246 million as an amount available to spend in FY25. With the 50% of POMV going to the dividend, that would have a deficit of $668 million. And then the statutory PFD is in the governor's budget, you'd have about a $1.1 billion deficit. So, you know, depending on the size of the PFD you go with, we could either have $246 million available to $1.1 billion in deficit. So the next few slides are sort of where might that $246 million go, or how could the deficit get even bigger? So this is a repeat of a prior slide from the last meeting, but there's a few items where there's a list that gets funded, and we have in the left column the amount that the governor funded, and then we have the full list on the right. So the Renewable Energy Fund, the next round, the governor put in $5 million before that. We knew how many projects there were. That turns out to pay two and a partial project. The full list is $32 million. Last year, the legislature did fund quite a bit farther down the list than just the top two projects. I think we put in $10 million plus. I don't remember the exact number. I think the governor had $7.5 million, and we added to that. For school construction, the governor funds the top project. The full list is $260 million. For school major maintenance, the governor put in $4.3 million for the top two projects. The full list is $249 million. And then for deferred maintenance, there's a total backlog of nearly $2.2 billion. The governor has $28 million from the Alaska Capital Income Fund, and we could fund any amount of that. The university has requested at least $35 million. They've said that they want legislation that would give them more flexibility on that funding, but I think they would be happy to get $30 to $35 million anyway. Currently, the governor gave them, I think, about $4 million for that in the operating budget, but none in the capital, so doesn't really increase the amount they're able to spend beyond a few million. And again, they have about $1.5 billion of that backlog, so the vast majority of the backlog is at the university at this point.
Mr. Painter, it'd be helpful to the committee, I think, if you put a little white paper together, not in too great a detail, but just high level over the last decade on the major maintenance expenditures so we can see the trends. And I'm not asking for an itemized list within that, but just in the categories of K-12, the university, the state, maybe courts, so we can get an idea of what kind of maintenance, major maintenance numbers have been used previously, because we're going to have that discussion here at the table when we make that decision if we're going to increase major maintenance for schools and or school construction. We might as well include that one too. And that way we'd have it all on one sheet, and we'll talk about that at a future time when we try to decide on the numerics of what we're going to plug in here. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Good morning, Mr. Painter. Do you know the balance of the Alaska Capital Income Fund?
Through the Chair, Senator Merrick, so at the end of FY24, we're anticipating it'll have a slight negative balance due to the realized income in the permanent fund. So far, I think their current forecast is slightly under the projection that they had last spring. The way money flows into that fund is through realized income on the Amerad Hess balance in the permanent fund. That's a fixed balance, excuse me, but depending on how much income they're realizing, that percentage carries out to that fund. So we'd appropriated last spring based on the forecast at the time. They've been slightly under it. So right now, slight negative. The 28.2 would be the full projected deposit in FY25. Leaving the fund still a little bit negative, depending on how things finish the year in FY24.
Thank you.
Are there questions on slide 6? Okay, we're on slide 7.
All right, so going on to additional items. So last year, the governor vetoed $30 million for community assistance. That was the FY24 capitalization. The way that fund works is one-third of the balance as of June 30th goes out on July 1st of the fiscal year. So the balance on June 30th of FY24 without that capitalization will be $60 million, so one-third would be $20 million. So the $20 million distribution pays for the base payments, but that doesn't allow for much of a per capita payment. So the impact would be felt larger in urban communities that rely more heavily on that per capita payment. So the House Finance CS of the operating budget, instead of putting that $30 million in, put $10 million in for this purpose in FY25. That increases the FY25 distribution to $30 million by just adding 10, but it doesn't put it in the fund, so the fund would still be short in FY26. So it avoids any impact to communities this year, but would still leave the fund short, but would save $20 million versus, you know, the alternative of putting the full 30 in. So I mentioned a few bills that have passed one body already, a few more that have passed. HB 89 passed the House. That's a child care bill. It has a $5.9 million UGF cost and then has a tax credit that has an estimated impact of $4.8 million of revenue decrease. SB 104, the Civil Legal Services Fund, would transfer additional money into that fund, reducing general fund revenue available by $444,800. And then SB 24, mental health education, at a $256,000 UGF cost. So not as big. The bulk of the cost of legislation that passed one or both bodies is SB 140 and then HB 89. And there are many bills that are currently in one finance committee or another, or passed a finance committee but not made it through the floor in one body or the other. It's a little too early to quite figure out where we might be at the end of session, but there are quite a few bills that are alive and could have fiscal impacts as we get closer to the end. On the capital budget side, we have the governor's capital budget of $297 million. District projects for your Senate districts, and then any other legislative capital budget additions are not included. One of the things I brought up at the last version of this hearing was the Alaska Energy Authority's GRIP project, the Grid Resilience and Innovation Partnership Project. That had not been funded in prior budgets. The governor's amendments last week did provide funding for that of $32.7 million from several different sources. Part of that is made up from using the ADA dividend to pay for it. Part of it is from reappropriations of past AEA projects to that purpose. And then $20 million of that, the bulk of the funding, would come from repurposing existing AEA bond, $20 million of the proceeds to this project. So there's some efficiencies that with the two lines would reduce that existing upgrade project, the need for it, but there's quite a bit of work that needs to be done on the transmission lines regardless. So it is a choice to use that $20 million instead of putting in state funds. Those funds could be used for that purpose, but they do have authorization now to use that $20 million of bonding. So it's a pretty stable fund source. I think when I'd spoken to you before, there was some concern that repurposing those bonds may have to go back to the bondholders and go through an extensive process. They did go through that extensive process and got that approval. Very quick work, and we're pretty impressed that AEA was able to do that quickly, but they do have that approval. So the $32.7 million of funding they have should be sufficient to get through this year's field season, but would leave questions about how to fund it next year. Then on the operating budget side, or both sides, the University of Alaska's budget, there's a pretty significant difference between the regents request, which is in what's called the Red Book, the University Regents request, and the governor's, mostly in that the governor used university receipts in place of general funds in many cases, and that university receipts are not expected to have a significant increase in the amount available, so that maybe hollow receipt authority. There's an $18.6 million difference between the regents request for the operating budget and then the capital budget. There's a $27 million difference between the regents request and the governor's budget. Another item that has come up a lot is replacing one-time items that we funded in FY24. Last year, we had $7.5 million for childcare for additional wages to providers. That is not repeated in the governor's budget. So that's potentially a $7.5 million difference for those employees or for those employees because it's funding their wages. I would note that HB 89 mostly has increases on the employer side, so it would be increasing tax credits to allow people or corporations or companies to reduce the cost of offering childcare. It doesn't necessarily directly tie to wages. So while they're related, they aren't necessarily perfect substitutes between that bill and that funding. The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault had $3.7 million of one-time items that are expiring. There's significant hollow federal authority in their budget because of declining Victims of Crime Act funding, VOCA funding from the federal government. We filled that with one-time items in many cases, and there's about a $3.7 million hole. Last year, we also had $2.5 million for Head Start as a one-time item to increase wages for those providers. It was $5 million in the legislative budget, got vetoed down to $2.5. The governor didn't repeat that. There's other items that I could mention to keep going of things that were funded last year that aren't yet funded this year. There's a few that are where there were COVID funds, federal funds that were used for purposes. Those funds are now expiring, and some people would like to continue those programs. There was a lot of public testimony last week in the other body about some increased rates in the senior and disability services program that were funded with COVID funds, and then those are expiring. So that's just an example. I think that's about $2.7 million that the advocates have asked for. There's a lot of those items out there of things that have been funded that potentially are going away this year. And then there may be additional items that emerge in the subcommittee process as priorities for the legislature.
And then, Mr. Painter, could you help the committee with another little brief white paper, just a list of those items that were one-time funded, just so we can help keep straight which ones are in, which ones are out, and so on and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we can provide that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, as we're trying to wrap our brains around all the pieces, Your earlier slide had, I think, $11.4 million fiscal notes for bills that are passed one body or the other. Is that both years, or is that just bills that have passed this year? And is that both operating and capital fiscal notes?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's both years. I think that incorporates, there's a couple of bills that have passed that don't have updated fiscal notes this year because they haven't been heard in the other body after passing one body. But I think that, I'm not sure if those are included, the ones that have not yet even been heard in the second body because they don't have updated fiscal notes. But we did include all of the ones that have updated fiscal notes this year. So there may be a few more that we're not quite capturing yet just because they haven't had recent movement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And yes, to your question about it, we are incorporating capital as
well. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, thanks for coming out this morning and clearing up some of these questions that we have. One of the calls we had recently was from one of the communities that was, as we go through these gyrations on your first bullet point up there, about the $30 million, that was vetoed, and keeping the concept that a third of the fund goes to community assistance, and then you got the $20 million and the $10 million and all these gyrations of tens of millions of dollars. I guess they were asking, what can the communities expect in next year or 2 years from now if this continues like this and not the normal way we normally figure out what community assistance is?
Co-Chair Olson, through the chair. So with community assistance in FY25, if we do nothing, we would get the $20 million distribution. So that would be the base payment only.
Mm-hmm.
If we take action, again, that would increase those per capita payments, but that's sort of where the swing is. In FY26, the governor's budget has $30 million, so you'd end up with about $23 million going out in FY26 if we do nothing but what's in the governor's budget. So that would pay the base payment plus a little bit of the per capita, but about a third of the total amount.
Mr. Chairman, I just put a bottom line on that so they can expect less next year than the year after if things continue as they are.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. I think they would expect a little more in FY26 than FY25 just because the governor vetoed the 24 amount but is putting in the 25 amount, so you're increasing the amount in the fund over time there. So it would be a little bit more in 26 and 25, but at least it would guarantee the base payments, so the difference would be that marginal amount of per capita payment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think, Senator Olson, it would be good to have Ledge Finance come back with their spreadsheet sometime. We'll take a look at it. So it's easier for the public to see the difference between the base payment and the per capita, because it does make a difference around.
I think the main thing is communities wanted to know what they can expect. Mm-hmm. Do they need to start tightening their belts tighter than they are, or mm-hmm. can they go ahead and coast a bit?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so we'll have him come back because we need to put a finer detail on it so we can decide what we want to recommend in the budget collectively here at the table. And then, Mr. Painter, I don't think you've addressed headroom yet or some amount of funds you would recommend being left on the table in case we have unforeseen expenditures between May and December, or actually May and next June.
Mr. Chairman, so that kind of ties into my next slide about fire and disasters, because that's one of those buckets. And this is a repeat slide, so I won't spend much time on it, but so one of the items that's not fully funded in this year's budget or most budgets is fire suppression. We have an amount in the budget right now of $14.2 million. The average fire season costs about $49 million of UGF, so there's a $35 million difference between the average season and what we have in the budget. So that means in an average year, if this is an average year, we'd need to come back with a $35 million supplemental. And, you know, if you look at the trend, you may notice that FY 2020, 22, and 23 were all above the average. So there's some reason to believe we might be seeing a bit of an increase in the cost of the fire season. Part of that may be an issue of relying more heavily on outside crews versus employed crews. We have a $75 million supplemental for this purpose in FY 24. So, again, that would be over the average now for the last 5 years. And then the disaster relief fund, we've sort of put in money sporadically. The governor's budget is asking for $5 million. If we assume an average number of future disasters, which obviously are difficult to predict, but if we an average spend of that fund, we would need $15.5 million more. So we need to put in about $20.5 million a year to just pay for an average amount of disasters. So if you add those up, you get about $50 million. Just in an average year, we would need about $50 million for future disasters. And so in our long-term modeling, we often put in this $50 million supplemental placeholder. That's sort of what that is representing in a lot of ways, is that $50 million hole between the average disaster funding and the current year. In addition, there are emergent items every year. The largest one this year was the Department of Corrections. That's possible that could happen to the Department of Corrections. Again, they're currently in negotiations on some contracts that could become very expensive for their CRCs, the community residential centers. So it's possible that at the governor's level, budget's level of funding, we could come back for a substantial supplemental for corrections again, depending on how that goes. So some of these other items that came up this year, we always have other emergent items, not just the disasters. There are a couple of ways to handle that. One would be to leave some extra room with the forecast. Another would be to have access to the Constitutional Budget Reserve to fill a deficit that arises. Or another would be to assume we'll deal with it next year. So last year we faced that situation. Oil dropped between the spring forecast in 2022 and the spring forecast in 2023. And so the legislature came back and voted to access the CBR to pay for FY23 supplementals and the FY23 budget as it already existed. So you can potentially deal with it next year. It just puts off that decision to fill the hole. So there's a few, you know, risks you face. There's these new costs that you may or will likely face with fires and disasters and agency items that come up. And then there's oil price volatility. So how much room you want to leave is kind of a policy call of how much do you want to deal with this year versus next year have fewer options with the legislature. Last year, we had very little option but to vote to access the CBR because even without any supplementals, we wouldn't have funded the budget based on the spring forecast. The higher a oil price you're budgeting on, the more likely it is that we'll face a shortfall the prior year or the next year. So, you know, budgeting this year on $78 oil is certainly riskier than if we budgeted on $70 oil. You know, it'd probably be prudent to at least have a savings balance or access to that savings or have more headroom before you need a CBR vote. But a lot of that is a question of, you know, the position you want to leave the next legislature in, essentially. Do you want to leave them with a CBR vote and CBR access or and headroom to potentially spend, or do you want to leave them where if prices drop or disasters happen, they have to figure it out? So I guess that's a policy call for you about how to deal with that.
So it looks like if we do the BSA increase of $174.6 million, regardless of the outcome of the vote today, but if we have that $680 BSA increase, it's $174.6 million, we deal with the AMS shortfall a little bit, community assistance, and we look a little, put a little bit in, $10 million or so in school construction and deferred maintenance, give that a huge haircut, but increase it a little bit, you know, $25 million or so, deal with a couple of this child care, home and community-based systems that we've got, services that we did last year in the budget were about 7.5 each, we're already right under $74 a barrel oil, which is not much of a margin because the barrel target is 78. So just trying to put it in scale to those watching. If we're at 74 and our target is 78, our price target is 78, and we're sitting at around 74 before we start taking a look at some of this other stuff, and we're looking at about 50 million, 45 to 50 million per dollar, increase in the change, isn't that correct?
Sure, that's correct.
So that's about $200 million. So if we want to have a dollar I mean, that's pretty tight. $2 is pretty tight. So I think we're going to have a pretty snug budget when we're done here at the table. And I think it'll be helpful when we come back, Mr. Painter, if we actually have a column list of these items and we can put up on the screen just like we do the long-term forecasts where you can sit and turn them on and off type of thing. And we'll put them up there so people can see how tight it is, because I don't think I think people are going to be surprised when we actually start looking at some of these, the main necessity things we have to fund, not counting all the feel-good stuff. So, Senator Bishop.
Yes, John, I don't have a question, just a comment. I mean, every year we come back here and look at this budget and we're wringing our hands and throwing a dart against the wall, and we have good forecasting numbers, but it all revolves around what the price of oil is going to do in the budget. And if this doesn't tell you that we need to diversify our economy, nothing does.
Well, you open that door, Senator Bishop. All these discussions today have no assistance for the fishing industry.
Nothing.
That's in a tailspin. So we can put that in the list of things that we need to consider too. So we're going to have some tough decisions to make the next couple months.
Mr. Chairman, one thing I'd add on to that is that, you know, the price forecast by the futures market and the analysts, if you saw that slide by the Department of Revenue, both are kind of downward pointed over the future. The EIA has a more optimistic case, but they generally are the more optimistic forecaster. So, you know, decisions we make this year, to the degree that they're built into the future and that they're either built into the base budget or create an expectation, as we've seen with some of these one-time funded items where it often creates an expectation that that service level will continue. If prices decline, then even if we made it work at $78 oil this year, and next year we have $74 oil, you may face an even tighter budget situation. So, you know, the decisions we make this year on higher oil prices than are expected over the long term could lead to an even tighter budget in the future.
I think we'll go on to the next slide to make us feel even better when we talk about tech budgets.
Mr. Chairman, so this is a slide that I think we had shown a version of this 2 years ago, and you asked for a new version. This compares the budgeted positions in last year's budget management plan to the governor's amended budget, including the new amendments, just to show the increases. So you can see that there's no places where the governor's reducing the amount of positions. There are quite a few where there's increases. In total, it's 115 new positions. I have the University of Alaska in here with no changes. They budget their positions a little differently, and that's a big chunk of them. But in total, it's, you know, 0.6% more positions, but 115 new ones. So generally, the trend here is towards more people, I suppose, not a smaller footprint of government in terms of where the governor's budget is headed.
So do we have an increasing population in the state the last couple of years that you're aware
Chairman,
of?
It's been pretty flat.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, as you look at the big differences that are on here, the biggest one that I see is the Department of Law. Can you just expand on that, the 34 people that are positions that you're trying to go ahead and fill? Are those lawyers or are they paralegals or people that are just office staff? Do you have any idea?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, so there's kind of a variety of the positions that are being added in the Department of Law. So they're adding some investigator positions that currently there are investigators in the Department of Public Safety, but none in the Department of Law. So they're adding their own investigator positions. They are adding attorneys that are in line with what had been originally projected for a need with the change in the definition of consent bill. So they're adding those attorneys now. They hadn't added them at the time because they had so many vacant positions they didn't want to keep adding, but now they're asking for those. They're also adding, and I don't know that they show up here because they're part-time, they're adding quite a number of intern positions that are now paid to try to get more interns to create more of a pipeline. So it's a wide variety of types of positions that they're adding, but some of them are attorneys, some are investigators, and then some are these other types of positions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
And then can you remind us our rough vacancy rate? If we had the vacancy rates here on all these agencies, are we, is there like no vacancy rates or lots of vacancy rates?
Mr. Chairman, statewide, we're at about 14% of vacant full-time, permanent full-time positions. And there's huge differences between agencies, but that's about the average overall.
Okay. And if you, how does that look historically? Is around, you know, the low teens normal or abnormal?
Mr. Chairman, it's been the normal the last few years, but if you go back to prior to the last 4 or 5 years, no, we had lower vacancy rates. In the budget, we typically budget a vacancy factor in programs between 0 and 7%, with 7% reflecting kind of what's considered a high vacancy rate. We don't typically see vacancy factors above 7%, so that may give you an idea of what's considered normal, would be up to 7%. But we've seen them, you know, statewide in excess of 15% the last few years, but that has started to come down just a little bit in the last few months.
Okay. Any other questions on this slide? Mr. Painter, last slide.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any other questions, and I'll be back with those further information that you requested in the future.
I think it would be helpful for the committee to see kind of the laundry list and see, because when we look at the dollar spread from roughly 73, 74 up to 78, there's not a lot of room there. And we also have the capital budget, and the capital budget chairman will be here coming in today, and that process is going to start underway. So that's another area that we haven't talked about here as far as the dollar amount that needs to be plugged into this revenue stream. Any other final questions, comments, or anything from the committee members? Seeing none, that concludes today's meeting. I'd like to thank Ledge Finance for coming in again and talking about our financial position. We look forward to his information back and working with not only legislative finance, but also the administration as we put this budget together for the best interest of all the people around the state. And we will continue for the next couple months on this. Tomorrow morning will be our next meeting at 9 a.m. tomorrow at 9. There will be two bills coming up. House Bill 125, trapping cabins on state land. That's trapping cabins on state land. House Bill 125. And then Senate Bill 207, Military and Veterans Family Help Desk. And that's Senate Bill 207. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., Senator Olson will chair. We are adjourned at 9:44 a.m. We are adjourned.